our theory of change is based on the premise that in order to get industries to change the means of production, if you like, which is generally the problem, we need to get to the investors and convince them of the fact that they are the people who can put pressure on companies to do things differently.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you. Your passion becomes theirs. I call this the power of purpose. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dominic Lyle of Planet Tracker, a non-profit think tank on a mission to drive sustainability within the global financial system. They want to align investment with a just, net zero, and nature positive economy. But what does that mean exactly? Well, imagine a world where investors not only consider financial returns, but also the environmental impact of their investment. And that's exactly what Planet Tracker is advocating for. Planet Tracker has influenced companies and investors to make lasting changes beneficial to both industry and the planet. Here to tell us more is Planet Tracker's Director of Comms, Dominic Lyle. Dominic has worked in marketing, PR and advertising for more than 40 years. He has been chairman of Porta Novelli, Director General of the European Association of Communications Agencies. Dominic, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Tell us a bit more about your journey to where you got to today.
Thank you, John. I'm very happy to be here. My journey is a long and rather random one, so I'll try to keep it as short as possible. I studied law in Switzerland for 3 years. I went into the catering business and ran restaurants in London back in the 70s for 6 years. I went into marketing and lived 4 years in Germany as a marketing manager for a sugar company. I then went into PR. As I left that company, I was offered a job with somebody starting up a PR company. I told him that I knew absolutely nothing about public relations, but he took me on nonetheless. And we had a very successful 10 years. And then I was taken on by what was then Countrywide Communications, which I think was one of the top five agencies in the UK. And they, two of my clients were sort of Brussels oriented, and I was spending more time there than in the UK. So I said to my boss, let me start an agency for you in Brussels. And he said, yes. And then we grew Porta Novelli Brussels. Porta Novelli took us over in the course of that move. And I became sort of director of the European network and then was on the international board as well and chairman, not of the whole of Porta Novelli, I have to say, but of the technology practice, which we call Convergence Group. And then I was headhunted to go and join the agency trade association, advertising agency trade association in Brussels, where I worked for 16 years. And then I retired because I was getting old, came back to London with my wife, and then I was having dinner with Robin Millington, who's the CEO of Planet Tracker, and she said, I've just started this NGO, and we need, you know, I don't know what to do about marketing and branding and strategy development. And I said, well, that's what I do, so why don't I come and work for you part-time? And of course, it's turned into a five-year permanent job. So that's where I am today.
And are you a big environmentalist yourself?
I have become much more so since I worked at Planet Tracker because I've seen what happens around the world and what goes on, you know, in industries and just how much greenwashing, if you like, is put forward about what people are doing and not acting on. So, yes, I am much more an environmentalist now, yes.
Yeah. And so tell us a bit more about how Planet Tracker works.
So Planet Tracker is an NGO. Our theory of change is based on the premise that in order to get industries to change the way in which they change the means of production, if you like, which is generally the problem, we need to get to the investors and convince them of the fact that they are the people who can put pressure on companies to do things differently. And we work partly by funding-driven choice. In other words, we have funders who will say, I want to focus on deforestation, or I want to focus on fishing, I want to focus on plastics. So we're kind of obliged to go after those industries a little bit. But what we do in each case is try to find out what problems are occurring in the supply chain. And often the problems are way back at the beginning of the process rather than at the sharp end. And then we will analyze those problems, analyze the companies that are working in that particular area, and then analyze the investors who are invested in those companies so that we can begin to explain what the problems are, what solutions could be, and how investors could help to solve the problems.
And then how do you identify those companies and financiers that are contributing to unsustainable practices?
There are plenty of sources for that. I mean, if you look, let's take an example of textiles industry, for example. We've just published a series of reports on water risk in the textiles industry, most of which occurs upstream, so that people who are growing and cotton and producing, you know, the raw materials at the beginning are using most of the water, and generally speaking, they're in very distressed, water-stressed areas of the world. So there's a sort of double problem there. And the only way to solve it, because they often are smaller companies, is to get the brands who are recognized by the public and by the investors, and where most of the investment money is going, to realize that down that supply chain, or up that supply chain, if you want to say it, are lots of companies that really need financial help in order to change the way in which they do things. And that if they don't change, then further down the line, the investments are going to be vulnerable because those industries are not necessarily sustainable in the long term. So how do we identify them? We use various databases to, like Refinitiv, for example, Bloomberg and others, to research companies. And you can get an enormous amount of information about them. In other areas, like fishing, we can actually track individual boats back to the owners of the boats. So there are plenty of databases that help you to do that. Yeah.
Can you give us some examples of your biggest success stories?
Gosh, that's a very interesting question, because actually tying what we do into, you know, causal results is sometimes quite hard. But I think two areas that I would highlight. One is we've been publishing a series of climate transition analyses of companies. So we did a series on FMCG companies like Procter & Gamble and Unilever and Coca-Cola and Pepsi and things. And we did a series on chemical companies. These are all companies which are members of the CTA 100. So by analyzing them, what we're doing is looking at what they say they're going to achieve by 2030 or 2050, and then working out what we think they can achieve based on what they've invested and what they're actually doing. And there's obviously a gap in some cases, not all, but most cases. So what we're doing is highlighting the gap and challenging them to do better, really. And why that's been successful is that the companies, because they're high-profile brands, generally speaking, are very sensitive to their reputations and very sensitive to criticism. But criticism is quite a harsh word, because what we're doing is analysing what's actually happening. And they respond quite willingly and quite quickly to those suggestions. And in several cases, we've seen changes come over a period of 6 months or a year, which are aligned very much with what our recommendations have been. So I think that's one area where we've actually achieved change. Another one was in the plastics area, where there's an organization called the Alliance to End Plastic Waste, which sounds very positive. But when we looked at that, first of all, it's a sort of industry front for chemical companies and large plastic manufacturers. And second, it makes very exaggerated claims about what it can and has achieved. So we kind of published something called Barely Credible, which was an analysis of their activities. And as a result of that, after a little bit of argument back and forth, they have actually changed their objectives and changed their public stance on things. So that was a definite win for us.
Very good. So I think this is really one of the strongest areas of communications at the moment, which is holding feet to the fire. And also, you know, as you've pointed out there, 20 odd years ago, even 15 years ago, companies thought that they could do all their PR and communications based on look over here at the 5% we're doing over here and the good stuff, and don't look at the 95% of stuff that we're doing is bad. And they're getting caught out for that at the moment. There's a lot of focus on greenwashing.
Yes, very much.
Yeah, another think tank that Higginson Strachey works with is called the Changing Markets Foundation. And they've been doing a lot of similar stuff as you, actually. They created a website called greenwash.com that listeners should go to. And there you can find all these green claims that are actually just rubbish. And I know all about the Alliance to End Plastic Waste, which, as you say, sounds absolutely wonderful, but is what is known as astroturfing. And for listeners that aren't massively into lobbying. It's a quite fun term, but you can imagine what that means. It's not real grass, it's fake grass. So they're pretending to be grassroots, but it's fake grass. And so it's where industry will get together, pay a lobbying firm to create what looks like an NGO from the outside. And then, as Dominic Lyle's team has found out, it's actually just a big front so that you can have this clever name and website and everything else, pretending that they're out there pushing for the end to plastic waste, while in reality, they're entirely funded by the plastic industry and they're not trying to do that whatsoever.
What they're trying to do is to divert attention from the production end so that they can continue producing plastics and blame it all on the consumer for not recycling enough. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and that's been happening in the plastics industry for decades. They've always blamed the litter bug. So it's all down to the litter bug. So that's why it's taken decades and decades. We're currently looking at EU level at extended producer responsibility, which means suddenly putting the cost of that litter, which has always been in the hands of the consumer. It's your responsibility. You've taken your product, you've got the packaging there, now you have to do something with it, and putting it that back to the producer and saying, no, sorry, this is your responsibility. You know that as soon as this item has been consumed, this piece of packaging is going to be out there in the environment, and you have to have a bit more thought as to what happens to it. So that's one of those things that's being debated at EU level. And that would be absolutely fantastic when those things come through, because it will mean a whole bunch of things for people. It's about mixed materials, recyclability, what happens on the end of life. And it moves us closer towards a circular economy once the manufacturer has to start thinking about the waste at the end of it. So what are some of the challenges that Planet Tracker faces in its efforts to kind of influence companies?
Well, I mean, the most obvious one straight away is that people don't want to change. They don't want change that affects their daily operations. So getting people to accept that change is necessary is a big challenge in the first place. From the investor perspective, I think that investors naturally tend to be profit-driven because that's what they're there for. So getting them to accept that that is not necessarily the most productive way to do business is a challenge. But once they do, then I think, things can change fairly rapidly. So I think persuading people. The other challenge I think we've faced is that there's been so much concentration on climate change in the last few years that nature has been rather forgotten. And we're very much about nature and not about climate change, although the two are linked to some extent. But what we're trying to argue now is that actually they're both sides of the same coin, and you can't have one without the other. You just address climate change and forget about nature. So our new sort of platform, if you want, is convincing people that nature is an economic benefit to the world. It isn't something that you could just say, well, isn't it nice to have flowers and trees and things? It's actually fundamentally part of the economy. And it's a very productive part of the economy if you treat it right, because it's free and it's very, it contributes an enormous amount to the GDP of the world. So getting this sort of climate-nature nexus understood and accepted is kind of our big crusade at the moment, I'd say.
Great. Well, that's really fantastic stuff. And I hope you'll work with some of those other NGOs out there like Stop Ecocide International and others that are doing something very similar on the pushing forward biodiversity, species loss and nature as being on the forefront as well. I just skirted over your career, but you've had a long and fruitful career that's been very successful. What have been some of the biggest communications wins that you've had over the years?
Well, gosh, if I think back to my time in PR, I would think, I had so many wonderful clients. I think the most exciting client I had was the European Space Agency, actually, when I was in Brussels, which we won. Well, I mean, there were quite other big agencies involved, but we won it and had a wonderful time working. They were a terrific team based in the Netherlands. And the year we were running the Cassini-Huygens launch, the satellite, which was really exciting. And I think that was a major sort of win for me. The other one that I would pick out was BT Europe, to clients of mine for about 10 years, both in London, and then I took it to, that was one of the ones that got me to Brussels. That was fascinating because telecoms at that time was sort of beginning a whole new era of expansion and technological advance and things. So it was very exciting. And BT, of course, though it's very well known in the UK, was not so well known or understood in Europe. So there was quite a big challenge to get what they were doing across to the European media and across to the European business community. So that was very exciting as well, because there's so many to pick from. Yeah, I think I'd pick those two as being highlights of my career.
And what for you makes a good message?
A good message is one that resonates with the audience. So I think you have to have a message which is acceptable to people in the sense that they can easily grasp what you're trying to say and that it has some connection with them. If you don't connect, you can make the most intelligent message in the world, but it won't be listened to or won't be heard properly. And to get people to act on a message, you really need to find something that hits them, you know, where it matters, whether that's their wallet or whether it's their mind or whether it's their conscience or whatever it is. I think that's the important thing about messaging, is to make it as relevant as possible to the audience.
Great. Now, I ask this question of all my guests. What media do you consume? Where do you get your information from?
Well, because we work across such a wide range of industries, so we do, you know, fishing, deep sea mining, plastics, petrochemicals, textiles, you know, agriculture, deforestation, all that sort of stuff. I get it from trade press across those areas. A lot of it is environmentally focused, so I read The Guardian, The Financial Times, but also other things like Environmental Finance, Responsible Investor, things which are more financially or economically oriented. Just to keep up with what's going on. We have a call every Thursday where everybody brings news stories for about an hour in the morning, all the team. So we have to research stories that we think are interesting. So you pick up a lot from that, and we share information between ourselves. And I'm on news feeds, obviously, as well, so that I know what's going on. I use a media monitoring agency so that I can check every day, you know, what's happening to us, but also what's happening to the markets in which we work as well.
And which news feeds do you use?
I'm signed up to Sustainable Views, which is the FT newsletter, Responsible Investor. I think those are the main ones. Bloomberg, that's where we get these from.
And how about when you're on holiday and you're not consuming news for work purposes? Are you someone who switches off entirely and picks up a novel, or do you read a different paper?
No, I switch off for part of the day, and the rest of the time I'm actually online looking at what's going on and keeping in touch with the office, I'm afraid. Holidays are not my strongest point.
That's often the case with communicators, that they struggle with turning off. We were talking earlier about one of the campaigns that Higginson Strategy has been involved with recently, the WASPI campaign, Women Against State Pension Inequality. Yeah. And you were telling me that your wife is a WASPI woman. What do you think of that campaign?
I think it's absolutely amazing. I think it's really sad that I fear that the money to do it justice will not be available. I mean, the government needs the grey vote desperately at the moment, so they may well give in to some extent. But I think any compensation that comes out of it will be quite small, and I'm sure that the WASPI women would want a great deal more than is going to be paid out in the end. It's a grotesque unfairness.
Absolutely. Well, we've been working for that campaign for 3 years now, and the WASPI campaign has been running for at least another 3 or 4 years before that. The WASPI women, absolutely fantastic amount of energy. And what we have found is the post office scandal has been useful for us in awakening those journalists that we've been speaking to. We've found that suddenly they've said, oh, this could be the next big post office scandal that's on the horizon.
Yes.
So although that was absolutely awful as for the sub-postmasters, been very useful for us in terms of highlighting an outrage and a scandal that has been there all along and that the WASPI women have been shouting about for the last 7 years. So we've got our fingers crossed with that, as well as doing all the work we can on both the current government and the potential incumbent government.
Labour government, yeah.
That is looking like could be Labour at this stage, yeah, absolutely. But as you say, there are no promises yet on either. Lots of the same talk that has always been there. There is no money there. There's no money left. But as we've often found, governments can say there's no money left. And then when it gets, when the screws are turned tight enough, they find the money, as they did with the post office. As they did the post office scandal, and as they did when the banks all went bankrupt in 2008, suddenly the money was there. So we're certainly hopeful. Dominic Lyle, you've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose, produced this week by Catherine Kitchen. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson's strategy supports purpose-led organisations, please visit higginsonstrategy.com.